Okay, so I'm going to talk about how to generate cap spin liquids from stochastic measurement-only circuit. This is based on a collaboration with Ali Lavasani and Sagar Vijay, both from UC Santa Barbara. Ali is the one who did all the hard work. Actually, I'm probably the least important person in this collaboration. So let me first put on page on long-range entanglement, what it is and why it is interesting. So the strict definition is a state is long-range entangled if it cannot be converted into a product state by generalized stochastic local transformations. I do have a technical slide on the definition of this generalized stochastic local transformation, but I guess it's not too important here. Let me just explain the intuition behind this definition. It says that a state is long-range entangled if it cannot be massaged using local operations to be transformed into something that is not entangled. In other words, this entanglement is not incorporated in a local way. Okay, maybe an even easier way to understand this definition is to use examples. The long-range entangled states include the gapped topological ordered states and also gapless states. An important class of examples are quantum spin liquids and quantum Hall systems, and most recently, fractal phases of matter. But they do not include the conventional symmetry breaking states, such as the long-range magnetic ordered states or the symmetry protective topological phases. And the long-range entangled states, they are theoretically fundamentally interesting because they push the boundary of theoretical understanding of phases of matter. They have very rich phenomena, and they can be useful for quantum computation. I'm more from a condensed matter physics background. So if I say something that is not very familiar to the quantum information community, please feel free to ask me questions. So here is one page on why long-range entanglement might be useful. One of the motivation is to do quantum computation. And one of the biggest challenges in quantum computation is decoherence. That is the unavoidable interaction of the system with the environment, which actually effectively measures the system. And whatever information that is stored in the system will be lost after that interaction. So to do any quantum computation, we need to deal with decoherence. And there's a brilliant idea by these people saying that one can use long-range entangled states to encode quantum information, since by definition, this entanglement is stored not in a local way. So they are robust against local operations or errors. This information is in fact protected by topology. One example would be one can try to store the information, try to store qubits in a Taro code. If you're not familiar with the Taro code, it's okay. It's just a topological order state. If you put a system on a torus, it will have fourfold ground state degeneracy. And if you start from one ground state, one of the four ground state, you cannot get another ground state by doing some local operations, unless you do a sequence of operations that wind around some non-contractible loop of the torus. So from this point of view, the qubit is protected by topology, some global property of the system. Okay, now I'm gonna introduce some standard of whether some state is long-range entangled. So if someone gives you a state and asks you whether this state is long-range entangled, the definition that I previously showed you is not very helpful because the definition was like a state is long-range entangled if it cannot become product state using local operations. But the fact that you cannot find a local operation doesn't mean it really not exists practically. It may be just because you're not smart enough. So a more practical standard for long-range entanglement, one of the standards is topological entanglement entropy. So suppose you have a system where the entanglement is short-ranged. It typically had something called an error law, namely the entanglement entropy of some subregion of the system is some non-universal constant times the size of the boundary between the two subregions. Intuitively, this is because you can if the entanglement are short-ranged, it can be viewed as coming from the Bell pairs with one endpoint living inside subregion A, another endpoint living subregion B. And the number of such Bell pairs will be proportional to the size of the boundary between subregions A and B. And here is the definition of topological entanglement entropy. So you bipartite a system into four subregions, and you have this long expression. The motivation for this expression is the following. So let's first look at S sub A. So it's the entanglement entropy of the subregion A. And if the system is short-range entangled, then this S of A will be proportional to the size of the boundary, size of the interface between A and B, plus the size of the interface between A and C, plus the size of the interface between A and D. That's like the circumference of this subregion A. And you can also have similar expressions for all the other terms. And it turns out all these extensive contributions will cancel each other, which means, so if your state is short-range entangled, this expression S tuple will be zero. So whenever you have a state and you compute this expression, you get something non-zero. It means you must have long-range entanglement in your system. So that's why topological entanglement entropy is a manifestation of long-range entanglement. So we will use this concept later to judge whether we have a long-range entangled spin-locus state. Okay, one important class of examples, as I've mentioned, of long-range entangled states are quantum spin-locus.
Can I comment on the previous slide?
Yes.
So although usually this topological entanglement entropy works, but we know there are cases where it doesn't work, right? For some short-range entangled phases, this quantity can also be non-zero.
Are you referring to the sublating term of some short-range entangled states? For that one, it can be non-trivial even in a short-range entangled state. But this, like, you follow the precise construction, I think it's fine.
No.
Or are you referring to something like subsystem symmetry protected phase?
Right.
Okay. Thanks for the comment. That's a counterexample. Yes.
Thanks.
Quantum spin liquids, very roughly, they are liquids of disorder spins down to very low temperatures. So it's like the quantum fluctuations in a system prevents or forbids the magnetic ordering from happening, very roughly. And they are beyond the conventional Landau symmetry breaking paradigm, where the symmetry is a global symmetry. And physically, the quantum spin liquids are characterized by fractionalized excitations, long-range entanglement, as I've mentioned, and topological orders. And the theoretical tools most is usually gauge theory and sometimes topological field theory and category theory. So here are some simple figures about fractionalized charges. So if your elementary degrees of freedom in your system are electrons, then in quantum spin liquids, there can be emergent degrees of freedom that have fractionalized a charge called anions. So this is an example for nu equals 1/3 in a fractional quantum Hall effect. And here is another example where the electron, the spin and charge degrees of freedom of electron separates, which is also sort of typical in quantum spin liquids. Where do we find long-range entangled states or quantum spin liquids in theory or experiments or numerics? Usually we search for frustrations. That is, the different terms in the Hamiltonian do not commute or they just simply frustrate. So not all the terms in the Hamiltonian can be simultaneously satisfied. So that's where frustration happens and the long-range ordering is hard to realize. So what types of frustrations that will usually be helpful in finding spin liquids? Those include geometric frustration, for example. You might have seen previously the figure of a triangular lattice, a triangle with anti-ferromagnetic easing interaction. So the two sides in a triangle wants to be opposite, but the third side is frustrated. So geometric frustration is like that. And one example is the nearest neighbor Heisenberg interaction on a Kagome lattice. And you can also have frustration coming from the competition between longer range interactions and shorter range interactions. And here's one example, the nearest neighbor plus next nearest neighbor Heisenberg model on a triangular lattice. And there is, you can also have computations arising from the anisotropic interactions with Kitaev-Honeycomb model being the famous example. which also inspired our setup. Okay, so although we have these guiding principles of finding these frustrations, but realistically in solid state materials, it's very hard to find quantum spin liquid states. Every now and then we see some proposals of some candidate materials, but then people debate all over them and it's very hard for everyone to agree. This is because the solid state materials are so rich and complicated. There are many factors to be taken into account of. So, then one natural thing people can think of is, can we constructively engineer the frustrations in certain systems? So one type of such systems is quantum simulators. When I say simulators, I don't mean numerics. I mean still some experimental platforms, but those systems can be rather precisely controlled in experiments. These platforms include, for example, trapped ions, ultracold atoms, and superconducting qubits. And as an example, last year there was an experimental paper using Rydberg atom arrays to realize Z2 quantum spin liquids. So this is the to my knowledge, is the first realization of quantum spin liquid in experiments that everyone would agree on. And so this talk explores a new source of frustration in addition to what I've described before, the geometric frustration, competition between longer range and short range, et cetera. So we will consider the competition between measurements as a new source of frustration. And so by competition, I mean the measurements do not commute with each other. So they cannot, so they will compete and inject entanglement into the system. So our slogan is, well, if measurement or decoherence are unavoidable, why don't we try to use it? Okay, a few slides on measurements for non-experts. We made with measurements every day. There are innocent ones, but there are also observer effects where the measurements that you do affect the system being measured. A classical example is when you try to measure the pressure of a tire. You need to let some air escape the tire to use the gauge to measure. But when you allow some air to escape, you're changing the pressure in the tire. So you're changing, your measurement is changing the system being measured. This is another typical example. You see some police officer measuring your speed and then you slow down. Okay, so in a quantum world, the effect of measurement can be more extreme. So as many people might naturally expect, measurements can destroy entanglement. So we start from a state of two qubits. The two qubits are in a Bell state. By Bell state, I mean the maximally entangled state between the two qubits. There are actually four Bell states, which form a basis of the two qubit Hilbert space. Okay, suppose we measure A, qubit A, in the computational basis, namely in the 0 or 1 basis. You get 0 or 1 with probability 1/2. And after the measurement, you don't have any entanglement left. Say if you measure 0, then the qubit B is also in 0, so there's no entanglement. But measurement can also create entanglement. So now consider an example where you have three qubits, where A is sort of decoupled and B and C are in some maximally entangled state. So if you try to measure B, C in the Bell basis, so in the basis of these four states, this measurement does nothing. It just tells you that B, C needs to be in this particular Bell state. But if you measure A, B in the Bell basis, it disentangles B and C, and it maximally entangles A and B. So we can see this in the following way. So originally, we have this state. We do an exact rewriting. We do a change of basis into the Bell basis. These four things are the four Bell states. And then after we measure the A, B qubits in the Bell basis, we can get, with probably 1/4, say we get 5+ state for A, B. And then the qubit C will be automatically in the 0. So after the measurement, we get C decoupled while A and B are maximally entangled. So this is like generating entanglement between A and B and removing entanglement between B and C. So if you like, you can measure B and C again in the Bell basis, which like regenerates the entanglement between B and C. So measurements can both destroy and generate entanglement. And both ideas have been explored in the literature. So the first papers in this field basically studied the circuits where you have unitary evolution, unitary gates applied to some initial states, and also some random measurements happens with certain probability p. So the unitary evolution will be the scrambling force that entangles the qubits in the system, while the projective random measurements will be like the disentangling force that that tries to purify the system. And these two forces will compete, and we have sort of a phase diagram. When we have a very large, when we have a larger probability of measurements, the system will be less entangled, and we will have a area law of entanglement entropy phase. And when the probability of measurement is smaller, well, the system will be more entangled, and you get a volume law phase, a volume law entanglement phase. And people have also explored how measurements may generate entanglement. There are several examples. People have used competing measurements to generate phase transitions and volume law in 1+1D. Also people have been trying to realize topological phases of matters such as Tower code. The way that they did it was to directly measure the Hamiltonian terms or the stabilizers in the Tower code phase. People have also considered using delicately designed sequence of measurements to generate protected qubits and topological phases or spin liquids. What we will do, what I will introduce in this talk will be a measurement-only circuit. So there are no unitaries anywhere. And I will have stochastic measurements only. So I don't have delicately designed sequence of measurements. I just allow the measurements to happen in a random way. So hopefully they are more robust. And what we'll generate are the Kitaev spin liquids and two protected qubits in certain region of the phase diagram. Okay, our setup is inspired by the Kitaev Honeycomb model. So I will do some brief reviews of that. So the system is defined on a honeycomb lattice. Degrees of freedom live on the sites. And there around each site, there are three types of bound corresponding to the three different directions. The Hamiltonian is anisotropic with exchange coupling Jx. This is the Pauli operator on x on the sites J and K. And we also have similar terms in other directions. So there are conserved quantities in this model, which the elementary ones are the small loop operators that are the Plaquette operators. It's a product of these bound operators around a hexagon. This commute with all these Hamiltonian terms and are thereby conserved. We also have the longer loop operators, which wind around the non-contractible cycles in your system. So suppose our system is defined on a two-dimensional torus, then this is one example of the long loop operator. It's a product of the bound operator along this path. It also commutes with all the Hamiltonian terms. To make any theoretical analytical progress, we do some Parton construction. We decompose each Pauli operator into two Majorana fermions. So basically each spin operator is decomposed into four Majorana fermions of different flavors. So poly X is BIX CI, poly Y is BIY CI, poly Z is BIZ CI. And so this Parton construction is enlarging the Hilbert space. So to get back to the physical Hilbert space, we need to in the end do some projection like this. The intuitive picture of Parton construction is that as I mentioned, quantum spin liquids, one of the features of it, it's fractionalized excitations. So to naturally describe something that is fractionalized, the theory, so it's natural for the theory to just fractionalize the elementary operators in the system in the beginning. Okay, so after this reparameterization, your Hamiltonian can be rewritten in this form. So we still have the Jx, Jy, and Jz, and we have this Uij, they're a quadratic term in B. They basically live on the bonds. INJ of color A, A being equal to X, Y, or Z. And the CIJ, CJ are the Majorana C operators. This UIJ effectively acts as the Z2 gauge fields and it commutes with the Hamiltonian. Okay, and so since it commutes with the Hamiltonian, the Hilbert space therefore decomposes into superselection sectors of different values of UIJ. So we can reduce this operator UIJ and view it as numbers when we focus in one superselection sector. And then the Hamiltonian becomes just a quadratic Hamiltonian of fermions, which we can easily diagonalize and solve for the spectrum. So it turns out the by tuning this JX, J1, JZ, we can have a following phase diagram. When one of the three J dominate, we can have a toric cold phase. That is the Z2 quantum spin liquid. When the three couplings are comparable, we have a gapless spin liquid in the middle. And if one can also compute the entanglement entropy in these phases. And for this shaped region, you always get this sort of formula. Alpha is a non-universal constant. L is the size of the boundary of your subregion A. And this is a sublating term corresponding to the topological entanglement entropy. Okay, that's a short review of Kitaev-Honeycomb model. So I will introduce my setup on the next slide. But before that, are there any questions for now? Okay, so then I'll move on to our setup. So we again focus on a honeycomb lattice. Our qubits will leave on the vertices, and our initial state will be a maximally mixed state. And the density operator is an identity matrix up to a normalization. And capital N is the number of sides of the system. So at each time of step, we choose randomly one side out of all the sides. And then around that side, we measure the bound operators X, X, or with probability PX. We measure Y, Y with probability PY. We measure Z, Z with PZ. And we require these three things to sum to one. So you always measure something around that side. And of course, they do not commute. The Plaquette operators, that is the Plaquette, the product of the bound operators around some hexagon, commute with all these measurements. And in fact, they are measured with constant rate in the circuit. Okay, a few words about stabilizer formalism. So the system size for numerics that we consider are L equals 40. The linear system size is 40 sites. And so the total number of sites is 2L squared. For a generic quantum system to simulate this many number of qubits, it requires like exponentially large computational costs. But there is an efficient description of stabilizer states, which is our case. It turns out it only requires 2n squared bits to specify an qubit state. So a very brief introduction to the stabilizer formalism. So suppose you have a state and you have something u that acts on the state, which keeps it invariant. This somethings belong to a group generated by this GI, a G1, G2, to GNs. Then this capital G is called the stabilizer group of this state. And when we're interested in computing the entanglement entropy in a system, we typically decompose this G into GA, GB, and GAB, A being the subregion. So GA is the stabilizer group elements that act only within the subregion A, and similar for GB. And GAB is the elements in the stabilizer group that acts on both subregion A and subregion B. And then, okay, so after this decomposition, the entanglement entropy in this subregion A is one half the rank of GAB in the units of log two. So here are two examples for the Bell state, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. The stabilizers are XX and ZZ. And they're non-trivial in both subregions. If we say, okay, first qubit is subregion A and second qubit is subregion B, then G is equal to GAB. And then rank of this is 2. So the entanglement entropy of this subregion A is 1. as expected. And similarly for the GHC state, we have 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, and this is a stabilizer group. If we choose A to be 1, 2 qubits and B to be the third qubit, we have GAB equals this generated by having these two generators. So the entanglement entropy using this formula is just a 1, also as expected. In our setup, we have all these Majorana fermions and also this anisotropic interactions. It turns out for our case, after some algebra, the entanglement entropy of some subregion A, disk-shaped subregion A, is equal to 1/2 of the number of plaquettes living on the boundary of the subregion A, plus 1/2 the number of either the Majorana dimers in the parton construction or the string operators in the original operators. So number of these things with one end in subregion A and a number of and another in the subregion B. Okay. And then technically, the quantities that we compute are averaged over an ensemble of randomly generated quantum trajectories. So basically, we ran a circuit for, say, 100 times, and then we compute entanglement entropy in each run, and then we average over all these results, and this will be the entanglement entropy of this region that we look at in the maps. Okay, here's one slide.
Excuse me. Why does the stabilizer formalism apply to GitHub spin liquid?
Why does it apply to GitHub spin liquid? We do have several stabilizers in this case, the plaquette operators and also the long loop operators.
But does it uniquely specify the ground state?
It does not uniquely specify the ground state. The plaquette operators do not. And we're never gonna measure the long loop operators.
So do you mean if we have both the long loop operators and also the plaquette operators, it uniquely specifies the ground state?
I don't think, I guess not necessarily.
Okay, but at the end, the entropy is given by the formula on this slide.
Yes, I think there's a question from
okay. Well, it's just a comment. My understanding of the stabilizer formalism requires that the operators have to commute, and I don't think they do in this example. I'm not clear on that. Maybe that's another way of saying that they have a unique ground state, but actually I'm not sure that it is either, because that's not the case with the toric code. Anyway, I think commutativity might turn out to be the issue here.
We're not really imposing the Hamiltonian GitHub honeycomb model. We do different measurements at each step. They do not commute, but at each time step, we'll have some stabilizers that commute with each other, yeah. Maybe it will become clearer later when I explain more about it.
There is a non-commutative generalization of the stabilizer formalism, and maybe that would work here.
Okay, thanks. I see. Here's a preview of results. So upon tuning the probabilities PX, P1, PZ, we can get two different types of steady states. One is what we call an error law phase, where the entanglement entropy has an error law form. By comparison, when the PX, PY, PZ are comparable, we get a critical phase in the sense that the entanglement entropy has some logarithmic violation of the error law. And we also studied the purification dynamics of the system. So S is the full entropy of the system. So initially we started from some maximally mixed state. So the entropy is very large, but then after all these measurements, after a very long time, the system will be purified. So the entropy will be zero. But how this entropy goes to zero will be different in these two phases. So I will explain in more details. Okay. Let me first look at the...
Before you continue, what's the connection between the phases on this phase diagram and the ground state phases of the KTIF model?
There is no direct connection. So, the corner, so the phase on the corner might have a, you might understand this as a excited state in the original KitLab honeycomb model in the torical phase. Well, for the phase in the middle, it's we don't know what it is. It's not directly related to the original phase in the KitLab model.
I see. Thanks.
Okay, let me first look at the boundary of this phase diagram. So one of the PIs is zero. Say we take PY to be zero, and we just have a number of chains of alternating measurements on the links. And so it's just PX plus PZ equals one. And it turns out after some local mappings, it can be mapped into this projective transverse AZ model. So with probability PX, you measure the XX link. With probability PZ, you measure the Z site. And it turns out this model was studied before, and it can be mapped to a 2D classical percolation problem. At the PC is 0.5, where the percolation happens. And here are some known results from at this limit. When P is smaller than PC or larger than PC, we both have error law entanglement in the system. But when P is equal to PC, we have this L log L behavior, which is sort of expected from the analysis of the percolation model. It's a conformal field theory behavior. This is also some known results where the effective center charge is 0.57, it's found in the max. Okay, so now I'm moving away from the phase boundary and going into the 2D, going to the region where all the three probabilities are non-zero. To make analytical progress, I'm again gonna do this parton construction into my runoff fermions. And the nice thing is that the projection into the physical Hilbert space, this thing commutes with all the spin measurements. So if you start from a physical state and do a measurement of spin, it will be equal to just you start from a Majorana fermion state and you do a measurement of Majorana fermions, and then you do the projection back to the physical Hilbert space. Then the problem nicely reduces to the evolution of just the Majorana partons, and then followed by a final projection in the end. Okay, so as I mentioned, the Plaquette operators, they will all be measured after a short period of time. So it's convenient to decompose the density matrix of the Majorana fermions into the density matrix of the B and C. And the B Majorana fermions will be, they will be in a pure state where each B is dimerized with its nearest neighbor. And all the further measurements of the bound operators will commute with this pure state. So this choice is nice because it also stabilizes all the Plaquette operators. Okay, so now the problem reduces to the evolution of just the Majorana C operators. And it turns out this model can be mapped to a classical loop model in 3D, where the C Majoranas live on the endpoints of the loops. So here, I have a figure, the black thing is the honeycomb lattice, while the blue thing is a world line of the Majorana C. So originally, the Majorana C just go straight up, so time goes up. But when, say, if this link is measured, then the Majorana fermions get reconnected, world lines get reconnected, So the model becomes just some word lines of Majorana fermions wiggling around. And so that's the loop model. And this loop model has been previously studied, and it has two phases. One is what we call a short loop phase, where Q of R is the length distribution of the loops, where the length of the loop is R. So in a short loop phase, Q of R is exponentially decay with respect to the size of the loop, exceeds some constant. And in the long loop phase, we have the probability of the loops being R just decaying algebraically. And we can use the stabilizer formulas, recall the entanglement entropies, just counting the number of Plaquette operators living on the boundary and also the number of Marana dimers cut by the boundary between the subregions A and B. So when one can use this lens distributions and integrate over the potential positions of the endpoints of the loops to find the entanglement entropy, find an estimation of the entanglement entropy. And indeed, for this short loop phase, we get some error law entanglement, which corresponds to the A phase in the phase diagram that I just showed you. And using this algebraic decay, we can get R log R entanglement, which corresponds to the critical phase.
So does the fermionic statistics play any role in this mapping to the loop model?
Sure. Yes, maybe, I think maybe, yeah. Okay, so this recoupling, let me say at some time T, you have this Marana C fermions connected in this way. And then now suppose you measure this link. After the measurement, the Marana fermions reconnect, the dimers reconnect. And this can be seen from algebraically from these expressions. So originally you have some three dimers corresponding to these three terms. And then after your measurement expressed in terms of pi, you get some three new dimers expressed in this way. So, and then technically the anti-commutation relation between the fermions will enter in this expression.
I see, thanks.
Okay, so that's, now let me explain a little bit about the purification dynamics of the system. To understand it, let me reorganize the degrees of freedom in the model because the different types of degrees of freedom disentangle from the environment with different rates. So initially you can view, so we started from some maximal and mixed state. So you can view all the degrees of freedom, all the qubits in the system are maximally entangled with some external qubits. And then after you do measurements on the system, you're disentangling these system qubits from external qubits, but you're entangling the system qubits with some other system qubits. So, okay, so we reorganize the qubits into three types. One is the Plaquette operators corresponding to the elementary hexagons in on the lattice. There are L squared minus one independent numbers of them. And there are also non-trivial cycle stabilizers. There are just two of them corresponding to the two big loops on the torus. And then we also have the bound operators, say of Z type, and there are also L squared minus one number of them. So these three classes will all commute with each other and they sum up to be the all the degrees of freedom in the system. So if we look at the purification dynamics, the Plaquette operators are responsible for the early time behavior of this purification. Since they're measured at constant rate, it leads to exponential drop of the entropy of the system. And while the non-trivial cycle stabilizers are responsible for the late time dynamics. So in the error law phase, recall that the length distribution of the loops decays exponentially. So it's hard to find some long dimers or long string operators in the error law phase. So the long cycle, this long cycle operators are very hard to get measured. So in this error law phase, the entropy will remain two for a very long time until some exponential time they get measured. Well, in the critical phase, the length distribution of the length distribution of the Marana loops is only algebraic decaying. So it decays slightly faster time at the order of L squared, the long cycle stabilizers will get measured. And this intermediate regime are described by the dynamics of the bound operators. So say right after the Plaquettes are measured, say we have a density matrix look like this, where the B Maranas, they have already dimerized with their neighbors, they form some pure state, but the C Marana fermions are still in some maximally mixed state. And then now we're gonna further pair up the C Marana fermions with each other. So And so in this figure, if we within the time window between T1 and T2, so a loop does not return to the initial time slice, it means that the reconnection of the Marana Sea word lines did not happen. So that they just go strictly up without like recoupling as in this figure. Okay, so if a loop does not return to the initial time slice, it means the reconnection didn't happen and the Marana remains entangled with the external qubit. But if the Marana returns, it means the C Marana is now dimerized with another C Marana and the entropy of the system therefore decreases by one. So the entropy basically counts the number of Marana loops that do not return to the initial time slice, but connects the top and bottom slices. So it's like a random walk of the loops. And in this language, entropy measures the probability of the non-returning walk. It's called the spanning number. And in a critical phase, we actually know from the loop model that the probability for the loop to not to return is proportional to T inverse. And the system size is like L squared. So so the total number of non-returning loops is L squared over T, which explains this T inverse behavior here. Well, in the error law phase, the spanning number decays exponentially because again, we don't have long loops. Okay, so one can therefore distinguish the two phases by just looking at the purification dynamics. So here are some remarks. The horizontal axis is Px. For convenience, I have chosen Px equals Py. This is the full entropy of the system. So we can see that at time of order L, in the error law phase, the only remaining entropy comes from the long cycle the qubits. So we have two here in units of log two. While in the critical phase, since the entropy decays as L squared over T, when T is of order L, the entropy is still linear in L. But now if we look at the case where T is equal to L squared, we can see that while the error law phase still has this two, the long cycle qubits, the critical phase has lost all its bound qubits and has reduced to zero. Okay, some more words on steady state. I guess I've already explained that when I answered Ryujun's question. So the bound measurements reconnect different dimer coverings of the honeycomb lattice. In terms of spins, a dimer corresponds to a product of bound operators with the two endpoints being the two endpoints of the Marana dimer. And again, different length distributions of dimers gives the entanglement scalings. Okay, let me just skip this. So here are, in the following, I'll show you some numerical results on the steady states. By steady states, I mean the region here. Okay. This hardest work was done by Ali Lavasani in our collaboration. To be more specific, by steady state, I mean the Plaquette and long cycle stabilizers the Plaquette stabilizers have been measured, and we initialized the measurements with all the Z-type bound operators. Then we ran circuit for all of L's time steps. So in the critical phase, based on the three-dimensional loop model, we know that the string operators have the length distribution of L to the power minus two. And this implies entanglement entropy of a subregion should behave as L log L or R log R. Indeed, so here's a plot for Px equals Py equals Pz equals 1/3, and the entanglement entropy of a cylindrical region as a function of the length. So the blue are the data points and the red is the L log L onsets, and we can see that it fits nicely. This sine function was motivated by the CFT calculation of a single interval at finite temperature. The prefactoring in front of the L log L, unfortunately, it's not universal and it changes inside the critical region, but it's always around, the change is always around 0.1, that is within the error bar. And this is like the measuring the length distribution of the either the string operator or the Marana dimer operator, and it has a power law behavior of minus three, matches with the expectations from the loop model. Okay, we can also look at the entanglement between the distinct the distant regions of the system. So we look at the mutual information defined in this way. So A and C are like far away. So again, we're taking Px equals Py for convenience, but when they are not equal, the qualitative behaviors are similar. So on the left, we have the RLL phase, while on the right, we have the critical phase. So on the left, we have one, which is because, so we can actually find that stabilizer that contributes to this one. So it has finite support in both A and C, but can now be decomposed into some operator just leaving A or C. While in the critical phase, it's actually linear in L, which can also be rather easily seen from dimensional analysis. So this is the length distribution of the loop operators in the critical phase. And then we integrate over the possible positions of the endpoint of the Majorana dimer or the loop. And so there are four integrations and there's only R to the minus three. So obviously we should get some linear in system size thing. That's the mutual information. We can also look at the long range entanglement. So this is the tripartite mutual information defined in the following way. So again, on the left, we have the RLL phase, on the right, we have critical phase. In the RLL phase, this tripartite mutual information is plus one, and in the critical phase, it's minus one. They can both be understood quite easily. And in the RLL phase, the loops are short, so there are not much mutual information between A and C. So the loops are short. So the contributions from I to A and B and contributions from I, A and B, C are the same. They will cancel each other. And the whole expression just reduces to I to A and C, which we studied before, and it was one. While in the critical phase, we can find one stabilizer that spans the whole region of A, B, and C, which contributes to this I3. We can also look at the topological entanglement entropy, which I introduced in the beginning as a standard for long range entanglement. So using this kind of Preskill setup, we can get the topological entanglement entropy to be flat and one throughout the phase diagram in both phases. So this resembles the case as in the original Kitab Honeycomb model, where also the topological entanglement entropy in the two phases are one in units of log two. This is because we always have that Z2 gauge structure in the plaquettes or the hexagons of the lattice. Okay. So since this I3, this tripartite mutual information is plus one and minus one in these two different phases, we can use it as an auto parameter. So near the phase transition, we assume this I3 is of this scaling form. And at Px equals Py, say, and away from the phase boundary, we can find the PC to be equal to this, which is consistent with the previous numerical results known from the loop model. While on the phase boundary where PC equals zero, we have a different value of PC equals 4/3 and U equals also equals 4/3. Wait, no, sorry, this PC is 0.5. Sorry, this is a typo, but U is 4/3. Okay. All right, so let me discuss analogs in the equilibrium. The RLL phase, so there are some hints. We have RLL entanglement, we have quantized topological entanglement entropy, we have two protected qubits due to long cycles. They are protected until exponential time. In the end, very late time, the two long qubits will get measured, but they will be protected until exponential time. And also they arise in the corner regions of the phase diagram. So all these seem to indicate that the RLL phase we get corresponds to the Z2 tower code on the torus in some specific super selection center. While the C phase, it has a log entanglement entropy. So it seems like some Majorana fermions has formed a Fermi surface. And it's, well, the behavior of the bipartite mutual information also seems to suggest that. But in our setup, it's not obvious what it means for the Majorana fermion to form a Fermi surface. We just have a state. We don't have like the whole spectrum or something. So, but if it really resembles a phase where the Majorana has formed a Fermi surface, it's that thing is not present, is not allowed in the original Kitab-Hanekamp model because the model has time reversal and translation symmetries. And using these symmetries, one can constrain the Fourier Hamiltonian of the Cmajorana fermions. And it turns out there's no way we can find a Fermi surface. The zero energy always happens at some like finite some discrete points of in the momentum space. It's never a finite region. So what might
so is the logarithmic correction additive or multiplicative?
Can you repeat the question?
Is the logarithmic correction to the area law additive or multiplicative?
You mean is it so the entangled entropy is like L log L, the leading contribution. So it's probably multiplicative in your So the time reversal and translation symmetries, in equilibrium, if both symmetries are present, then we cannot have this Fermi surface. So we try to look for cases where we break either the translation symmetry or also break the time reversal symmetry. When we break the translation symmetry using some disorders, adding randomness in spin exchange, the partons can be metallic where the states at zero energy are delocalized. But the entangled entropy has not been well studied in that case, so we don't know the direct connection. And when one can also consider breaking a time reversal symmetry by adding some next nearest neighbor terms. When both that terms and disorder are present, people have also found some metallic state where the fermionic proton wave functions are extended. But again, we cannot say anything direct. There's no direct evidence that these states really connect or really are the state that we found. So from this point of view, it seems that we have got a new spin local state. Okay, so finally, let me briefly discuss the robustness of the spin local state that we found. We can consider, I don't have much time left. So let me just briefly state the result. We can consider adding random single qubit measurements, such as just the single side measurement Z, with probability PS. It turns out as long as this PS is much smaller than the PXPY or PZ, these two phases are stable and the qualitative features remain the same. But you can also consider adding some 3-qubit measurements corresponding to gapping out the B phase in the original Kitab-Hanekamp model. This translates into the Majorana fermion language of adding next nearest neighbor Majorana terms. And it turns out the critical phase will flow to another critical phase after we add this perturbation. We again have the L log L entanglement behavior, but the coefficient in front of the L log L will be different. So finally, some summary. We used frustrated measurements to generate some logical qubits, and hopefully we can fight against decoherence use that logical qubits. And we find two spin local states. They both have non-trivial topological entanglement entropy. They're large entangled. One is similar to Tower cold, and the other seems new. And of course, there are many future directions to explore. Is there a nice decoding scheme for our model? And is there a better understanding of the critical phase? And can we generate more quantum spin liquids, especially the gapless ones? And but I've been thinking about this, but it's a little challenging because most of the current theoretical understandings are for translation invariant spin liquids. What I mean by that is the mean field onsets in a partner construction uses translation symmetry. That's the easy way for the theory to study those spin liquids. If there's no translation symmetry at all, then it's simply harder to do in theory. But while when we have measurements, their measurement outcomes are usually random. So there's no way that we can guarantee we get some uniform or regular flux pattern in the hopping of the fermions. So it's non-trivial to generate gapless fermion liquids, all of that, but it could be an interesting future direction to work on. And of course, there could be intrinsically new out of equilibrium states that are simply not present in the equilibrium. So that's also something interesting to think about. And there are many more questions to address. I guess that concludes my talk. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, let's thank Juicy for the great talk. Any questions?
Can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
Is it clear that the, I think you mentioned, but is it clear that the non-equilibrium state obtained in this way can be the ground state of any local Hamiltonian at all?
No, it's not clear. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also, in the previous slide, just one slide before, you mentioned, two more. You mentioned the effect of disorder. So in K-type model,
yeah, go ahead. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, in K-type model, if I add randomness, then from the perspective of the C fermions, so from the perspective of the Weisson will also see some random potentials. So I would expect there may also be some random flux. Then the C fermions will also see the random flux. Do they not localize?
Sorry, what is not localized?
The C fermions. Do they not localize? They were, I think they were in K-type model, if we introduce randomness, then I'm also introducing some random flux to the C fermions.
Yes.
Do the C fermions not localize?
There can be some phase where the C fermions are not localized.
Due to which symmetry?
Due to which symmetry? When you have disorder, again, not much symmetry.
In 1D and 2D, if there's no symmetry, fermions will necessarily localize. Only in 3D, there can be Anderson transition.
That's true. Okay, yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. And also, I think I missed something very basic. How did we see there's some protected qubit?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So these are the long cycle qubits. They are. So yeah. Let me show you this figure. We see the two protected qubits from this two here.
Oh, I see.
So they're like they're never measured until a very long time in the error log phase.
Uh huh. I see.
Yeah, it's a sort of, from this perspective, it's sort of similar to the Floquet code. We do all sorts of measurements, but the long cycle qubits are not measured.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, I just have one trivial question. So how do you get it curved? Is it analytical or?
Oh, sorry. So this is a schematic curve. Yeah, but we can see such behavior in numerics as well. Yeah.
I see. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. As long as thank you again.
Thank you.